This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Judith Tick. She is Professor Emerita of Music History at Northeastern University. And we're talking about her latest history, Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song. Judith, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about a labor of love that took me a very long time.
I was going to ask you about this because there are books. I have to read a lot of books, sometimes up to four a week. And I do read them cover to cover, but I can tell when there's a book that has taken the author a long time and it is a labor of love and a lot of research. And this is one of them. So talk to me, what attracted you to the subject?
The beginning of the attraction is so common to everybody who hears Ella's voice. There's something magical about it. It has this comfort and charisma built into it. So I grew up hearing the songbooks. I grew up in a family where my mother loved to dance. She even knew Chick Webb. She had been to see Chick Webb in 1936.
Oh, wow.
And can you imagine?
Yeah.
And she loved to dance. And so it wasn't just that she had the records of Ella. The spirit of music and dance was in my house. I didn't really understand all of this, but I loved the Cole Porter lyrics. And it was ingrained in me as a young girl. So as I became a music historian, and I did various topics, three strains came together to get me into the stage where I would sacrifice so much, not really sacrifice, but immerse myself in Ella Fitzgerald's life. One was my love for American music in general, and my belief that it all goes together. We separated into all these little categories, ever-growing bureaucratic categories, but it really all goes together. That's why Beyoncé is on the country music chart, and that's why. You know, it isn't so silo-like, and I loved that about it. Then women's history.
I'm a
total second-wave feminist, right out of the women's liberation movement. I was in Berkeley, California, and I understood what it was. I was experiencing so much prejudice trying to get a job or even being trained. So that motivated me to do women's history. I think the African American piece came after I taught a course in folklore, and I knew about jazz and blues superficially, but I began to understand the roots of women's music in Black culture very differently after I explored the 19th century, if you will. So it all came together after I wrote one biography of a folklorist composer named Ruth Crawford Seeger. I was ready after about 15 years to take on this one. And I'm not sorry. I didn't know what a joy it would be, and I didn't know what an adventure it would be, and I didn't know how lucky I was to hit it just at the right time when there was so much new material out there.
It is an amazing biography. I want to get back to the women's history part of it, because that was one of the sections that shocked me in this book, was how in the, I would say the 1930s, how jazz bands, really did not want a woman singer in their band.
No, they didn't.
It was like, and you know, you look at what we know now, and then you read, and then time and again that comes up, and in quotes. Was that shocking to you when you came across that?
Yes, because I didn't, it seems so counterintuitive. And yet that was the case. I think you can understand that by looking at bands in general. You know, jazz came out of marching bands. That's why we have New Orleans. And marching bands are related to war and military environments initially. So the marching band is the prototype of what a band is a very masculine kind of environment. And I think that that affected the early milieu of jazz, which became a way for black men to find an arena of excellence. And somehow the women were blues singers, or they were at the piano and church, doing church leading, which they were in the black world, and the women in the white world were, they had entertainments. I mean, certainly we had great actresses coming there, but it didn't go together. It was separatist in their thinking. That's it. You can have coexistence, and they were separate, and the women in jazz were not equal. Separate, but not equal.
It's interesting. The title of your book is Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, and as you write in the introduction, she was always becoming Ella Fitzgerald. And what and correct me if I'm wrong, she's always transitioning to different attitudes towards her music and the audience and the musicians that are working with her throughout her entire life. She's never standing still.
She's never standing still. You know, the part of Ella Fitzgerald's life that moved me the most was her blossoming in her 60s.
Yeah.
She was singing out in the 1970s, and she paired with Joe Pass, a young middle-aged white guitarist, bebop player, and she became so intimate in her delivery with Joe Pass. It was as if, because she didn't have the same chops that she had as a younger singer, of course, it's very hard to when you're in your 60s, she compensated through her creative imagination, and she produced these little gems of studies of American song. I don't think of that part of her career is well enough known, and it's quite remarkable. So she also worked with Basie, and Basie's guys loved her, and she loved them, and they're swinging away. She was indomitable in her ability to milk every ounce of joy from music, and she did it.
I was also surprised how much debate there was in the jazz press by the reviewers about her about her artistry. She got a lot of blowback for doing songs like Tisket Tasket. Like a song that she's like renowned for now. The jazz press was just like, they considered that beneath them, material that was not worthy of them.
Right.
That's insane.
Every developing profession goes through, and jazz critics in the 30s were pioneering an art form that had no respect. Jazz critics in the 40s were very marginal, and they got some chops in the 50s and 60s, and they had more publications, and jazz had far greater status as it entered the university and it entered college curriculums. But when they just brought their sense of privilege and entitlement to separate jazz from pop as their main mission. There was pop and there was jazz. You could call someone a great popular singer. That was one way of putting them down in a certain sense, but you couldn't call them a great jazz singer unless they passed every single test. Well, American music didn't work. Whether they liked it or not, jazz pop became in the hands of Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra, in particular, a great art form, a hybrid that had its own vigor. Gosh, did you ever watch that show about the British veterinarian? They're always talking about the vigor of hybridity. Well, that's exactly what... I can't remember the name of that show at this moment.
Is that All Creatures Great and Small?
Yes, All Creatures Great and Small. Every minute they're discussing about hybrid vigor. Well, there it is in American music. And you have to be able to accept that on its own terms and not decide you're going to separate which pure strain goes here and which pure strain goes there. It doesn't work that way, whether you like it or not. Look at Herbie Hancock, to name someone who really understands exploration. This is one of the gifts that jazz has given American culture. Why do we want to sit there and say, we're separating into categories.
But trust me, being at a jazz station, those discussions still go on today.
Yes. It's not surprising. It's part of our intellectual nature to do that. It doesn't really matter what field you're in. You can do that with cooking, for cuisine yep. and cooking. But that's not the nature of cultural evolution today. It's synthesis and global transfer.
Well, let's talk about Ella's early life, because you do okay. a phenomenal job of painting a beautiful, rich picture. She was born in Newport News,
yes.
but she ended up, the family moved to Yonkers.
Yes.
Now, as you describe her family and the other people in the neighborhood, you talk about the word striver.
Yes.
Talk to me about what that means.
Do you know there's a section in Harlem called Striver's Row? Huh. Striver was a compliment. It was a term of praise. It meant that no matter how deep American racism ran, you were not going to put your energies into worrying about it. You were going to put your energies and your life force into transcending it and going to fulfill yourself. That's what a striver is. And that is what it meant. It meant to have the courage to find out who you were and stand up for who you were, no matter what anyone else said you should be. And it meant putting ambition front and center that had healthy roots rather than bitter ones.
Yeah. Now, we can't give all the details out that are out in this book, because we'd be here for years and do a series of 100 interviews. But she lived in a house. She got piano lessons. She didn't stick out with them for a long time. But the family did own a phonograph and a radio, which at that time of the century, that's a big deal. She listened to the Mills Brothers, Mamie Smith, Connie Boswell, the Boswell sisters, big.
Yes.
Now, she originally wanted to make a name for herself as a dancer.
Of course, she was a young girl who was swinging and swing dancing and turkey trotting, and she thought she could make it because she saw the success that some singer dancers were making it, and she believed. I think this was surprising because she's painted as such a non-sensual person. She believed in herself enough to say she could be a dancer and a singer and get out there and imitate all kinds of eccentric dances, and that was her ambition. And she succeeded being a good tap dancer, and people knew her as both.
Wow.
Both in Yonkers. So she had to grow into the implications of her gift. She didn't prize her voice, and that Apollo story of discovering it is very important. It was the beginning of a long process where sometimes it takes a lifetime for an artist to understand what their gift really is and what to do with it.
Now, we have to talk about Harlem Amateur Hour, and her audition song was Judy. By the way, if you don't know how important this is, those amateur hours were huge. And the audience was very active in either appreciating you or not appreciating you. And her audition song, and she's very nervous, she's a young kid, is Judy by Hoagie Carmichael.
Yes.
Which is an interesting song because in some places the words were considered too racy for the radio.
Right.
Now, she planned on dancing, but she ended up singing.
But you know, in her audition, she sang. So Ralph Cooper knew she could sing.
Yeah.
It wasn't a big mystery to him that she could sing. He wanted her to sing. But she wasn't on the same page. So that was the disconnect. It's not as if she opened her mouth for the first time on stage and it was Eureka. She just didn't have her gifts in balance.
But I don't think she realized the audience would appreciate it so much.
No, but you know, we do have that strain. We have American Idol and The Voice.
Yep.
We have all these shows, these competition shows on television right now. So we do have that same kind of love for seeing people make it and win prizes and succeed if they're good.
Now, for her, the audience reaction to her singing.
Initially, it was, "Who are you? You look like a street child. Get off." And then when she opened up her mouth, as Norman Miller, who was there, says, and as the daughter of the owner, one of the partners of the Savoy Ballroom says, they recognized they were hearing a major gift, and they were quiet. The tough audience, because that's there. But maybe there are lots of tough audiences in the world. She had to deal with nightclub audiences that talked.
Well, that was a very competitive venue. It was incredibly competitive.
Yes, it was competitive because there were vaudeville acts all up and down the program, and the comedians, eccentric dancers, acrobats. Singers of all sorts, ballroom dance couples. I think it was a great playground and at the same time a great academy for her. Mm. It was a school. That's how you go to school. You watch what everybody does and you learn and they tell you and they help bring you up. They help raise you up. She learned in that environment.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Judith Tick. She is Professor Emerita of Music History at Northeastern University, and we're talking about her latest book. It is an amazing biography. Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song. It was in 1935, I think, that she finally started working with Chick Webb.
Yes. And now, he didn't want to take her. He thought she wasn't. First of all, he hired a boy singer. He had one. He had singers. And he had handsome Charles Linton, who was a little bit of a heartthrob. And why did he need another singer? It was going to come out of his payroll, and it was a girl singer, and that would just create trouble and havoc on the road, he thought. So he had to be persuaded, and it took a fair amount of persuasion to get him to even listen to her because he was so busy all of the time. But he had the same experience. She opened up her mouth, he heard the gift, and he recognized it. And it took him a while to integrate her into his practices of how he presented his band. He and his wife gave her a makeover. And then, over time, he realized whom he had with him, and he adopted her emotionally, not legally, as a kind of daughter, if you will.
Yeah.
It was Chickenella.
I know. Now,
it was a great partnership.
Again,
we have to describe, you know, he was not that much older than she was. He died in...
She was, 17 at this point?
17 or 18 in 1935. I guess he came up from a hardscrabble working class life in Baltimore. He had metastatic tuberculosis. He had a hunchback. He had chronic pain sometimes. He was in and out of hospitals. And he carried on. He kept on, as the phrase went. And so did Ella.
Yep.
They kept on, and they were total professionals.
As a matter of fact, she kept on after he passed on.
They gave her... She was so successful that Mo Gale, the manager, said she was going to be the titular head of the band. She knew she couldn't really tell everybody. She wasn't a manager or an organizer, but she looked for material, and she kept that band afloat. Kept them afloat during the war years when she was competing with no less than Glenn Miller, never mind Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw.
Now, she ended up singing and recording with Decca at the time. And this is the swinger. And Ella really sort of played into that. I think the first song on the Billboard charts that was her was Sing Me a Swing Song by Hoagy Carmichael.
Another Hoagy Carmichael. Yes.
And also Mr. Paganini. And you could find those in jukeboxes. The recordings made it up in jukeboxes at that time. So she was building up a huge popular fan base.
Yes, she was, especially in black neighborhoods where the playlists on their jukeboxes were different from those in whites. So crossing over from one to the other became something that the record company realized she could do.
And there were also these radio broadcasts.
Yes.
And that brought her a national audience.
That was through the genius and the entrepreneurial genius of Mo Gale, who had lots of connections down in the radio center of RKO. And he really cultivated business connections. And look, he specialized in black entertainment. He had a great niche because there was so much racism in the industry that he was able to capitalize on his exclusivity. He was known primarily for signing black artists.
Yep.
So he understood the potential of that fan base because his bands toured and they reached white audiences as well as black. He understood the potential of the black fan base at the same time that he wanted to keep it somewhat segregated. She didn't tour with white artists under Mogale. Everybody was black. The bands, the other acts on the show, she was in black theaters for most of the time. It really isn't until the late 40s that Ella is crossing over into, well, not just jazz clubs, but white nightclubs.
Right. I want to talk about a Tisket a Tasket. Okay, that now.
Maybe you played this.
I'm going to play it on the intro and outro. But this was very popular with audience, and she was really courting the jitterbugs at this time.
Yes.
And where did the song come from? I mean, that's one of her keynote songs.
Well, you know what? If you've ever, it's sidewalk gameplay for street kids.
Yeah.
They play a Tisket a Tasket. They play, it's a game song. You know, you go, it's a party song. You go around in a circle. One person is out and then you chase them. And here's the thing. There's this strain in African-American vernacular music that brings a sense of motion and wit to whatever they're doing because I could hear field recordings of a Tisket a Tasket from girls in North Carolina that had that spicy ting to it.
Yeah.
And I knew that Ella had played this game in Yonkers, and I knew she was drawing on truth and experience. Because it wasn't just a gimmick. It wasn't just a hook. It was from her own world. She's the one who thought she could do it. It's a very odd choice in a lot of ways. And it encountered a lot of resistance, again, from men in the business who wanted jazz to be seen as exotic and hot and dusky and slightly steamy. And
yes.
Certainly not Shirley Temple.
Well, you know,
right?
And one of the things you write about is that in the press, when things like this, when she came up with a song like this, I forget who the writer was, but it talked about her popularity undermined Webb's authenticity. And I thought of all the things that they wrote that was negative, that was really a cruel thing to say.
Yes, I think that was one or two jazz critics. Well, over time, these things, oh, it's hard to even explain. I know it was a cruel thing to say for Webb, but they really sloughed it off. They didn't take it too hard.
Okay.
Ella didn't really.
Still, it was not a great thing to write.
You look at what people, you look what you, I think what you're talking about is the strength to resist what is written about you, the strength to have enough determination to put it in perspective. I remember talking to Gunther Schuller. I don't know if that name means anything.
Oh, yeah, it does. Of course it does.
He wrote a book called The Swing Era.
Mm-hmm.
It's at least twice the size of my book, and it has brilliant musical examples. Well, I knew him. He lived in Boston, and I talked to him, and I asked him, why did he leave Ella Fitzgerald in such a marginal state when she was such a primary shaper of the swing era? And he did it because he didn't like the juvenile nature of the songs that she sang. He thought they cheapened jazz. He told me, he said there wasn't room for two, meaning if he had Billie Holiday in there, how could he have another chapter devoted to a female singer?
Whoa.
So then,
that's a red flag.
Really, it was, but you know, I really admired him so much.
What's interesting? We're almost out of time. She was in a singing competition with Billie Holiday, and it was declared a draw.
That's right, and they both competed with Count Basie against Count Basie against, I guess, Chick Webb. Yes, it was a draw. And no one, and that's wonderful that it was a draw. And everybody tripped all over themselves trying to decide who and what. Of course, it made great press.
Of course.
I think we need to understand controversy is contributing to our the lifeblood of what we want to hear. I don't have to explain to our audience how we're drowning and suffocating in that right now. But every artist goes through that. If you're not doing anything original and getting criticized, then what are you doing?
Now, we have literally 2 minutes left. She after Chick Webb passes on, she becomes the head of a big band.
Mm-hmm.
What a huge thing at that time. Oh. The response. And then she goes on the road. And that's another whole story of race and having
freedom
to
riders.
Live through.
Why don't we call them freedom riders? That's
yeah, Jim and Jane Crow, as you talk about it in the book. I mean, what a harrowing story that is, but they just sort of barnstormed across the United States.
Yes, they. You know what? Ella Fitzgerald's son, Ray Brown Jr. His father was the great bass player, Ray Brown. Ray Brown said to me, Ray Brown Jr. said, "Nobody toured like my mother."
Huh.
That's what he said. Nobody toured like my mother. And you know what else? We can end with this quote from Ray Brown Jr., whom I'm so grateful for so many insights. He said, "My mother was all about the audience."
Yep.
And he meant that in the most as a term of great, profound wisdom.
We're going to end it there. We'll have to have you come back. And I had like four more pages of questions. My guest tonight has been Judith Tick. She's Professor Emerita of Music History at Northeastern University. And we've been talking about her monumental biography, and it's really wonderful and rich. Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song. Judith, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Mark. It has been.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynn. Good night.
A brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mummy. On the way I dropped it, I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it. A little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket. She was trucking.